Star Trek Maverick, weaker. Join the USS Maverick, the newest Galaxy-class starship to be assigned to stand guard at the border between the Federation and the distant Delta Quadrant. Its mission to act as sentry post for any future Borg invasions after the events in Star Trek, First Contact. When a chance encounter with an ancient artifact unleashes a race of alien entities aboard the ship, Chris Larrabee and the men of the Maverick are forced to fight enemies wearing the faces of their women. No prior canon knowledge needed for Magnificent Seven. The crew of the Maverick are Captain Chris Larrabee, Commander Buck Wilmington, First Officer, Lieutenant Commander Alexandra Stiles, Science Officer, Lieutenant Commander Ezra Standish, Chief of Security, Lieutenant Mary Travis, Protocol Officer, Lieutenant Julia Pemberton, Chief Engineer, Dr. Nathan Jackson, Chief Medical Officer, Ship's Counselor Josiah Sanchez, Lieutenant Vin Tanner, the Officer of the Khan, Ensign J.D. Dunn, Navigator and Communications Officer. Also starring Inez Rosillos, Ship's Bartender, Casey Wells, Captain's Yeoman.
Prologue. Vacation. Captain's Log. Stardate 2375.0925. The Dominion War is over. Less than a week ago, the Founder signed the Declaration of Surrender on Cardassia Prime after fighting the largest military battle the Alpha Quadrant has ever seen. The Allied forces of the Federation, the Klingon Empire, and the Romulan Star Empire converged on Cardassian space. They fought their way back to Cardassia Prime to engage the forces of the Dominion, comprising the Jem'Hadar, the Breen, and the Cardassians. The Cardassians, who were more slaves to the Dominion than they were allies, chose that moment to throw off the shackles of their oppressors and joined the fight on the side of the Alpha Quadrant, paying a heavy price for their show of defection. The Founders ordered the orbital bombardment of the homeworld out of sheer spite. It reduced 3,000 years of civilization to rubble in less than an hour. The Alliance arrived on Cardassia Prime as the victors of the war, but there was nothing to celebrate. Cardassia has been bombed back to the Stone Age. The Alliance fleet has lost a third of its ships with heavy casualties. To my deep regret, among this number is Captain Rafael Castile of the Venture along with his crew. I expressed my personal condolences to his family and his fiancée, Inez Rosillos, who is still on board the Maverick in mourning. The Maverick came out of the battle well enough. We suffered minor damage, which was all but rectified at Deep Space Nine. There were casualties, but fortunately, no fatalities. We remained on DS9 for a few days following the surrender as Starfleet recruited Lieutenant Travis to aid the diplomatic corps in constructing the new treaty between the Dominion and the Alpha Quadrant. Most of the crew has requested shore leave. Under Counselor Sanchez's recommendation, I have decided a detour to Pacifica might not be such a bad idea before we return to the frontier. Captain's orders until then? Rest and relaxation.
I don't know, Alex.
Mary Travis said dubiously as both women waited for the turbo lift to deliver them to the bridge.
What about Billy? I wouldn't feel right about leaving him.
Mary had more or less given up calling her son William because everyone on board, including William, preferred Billy.
Oh God. Not this again.
Alex wondered why they were having this conversation yet again. Ever since Alex suggested the trip to Tethys Tourist Resort in Pacifica, Mary had teetered back and forth on her decision as she wrestled for her desire to get some well-needed rest and her responsibilities to Billy.
Didn't you tell me that Audrey King is organizing a field trip to the Oceanic Reserve for his entire class? He'll be up to his ears in pink-nosed leviathans and all kinds of marine life with kids his own age. Don't you want him to make more friends? Well, I can tell you, boys his age don't appreciate their mothers hanging around when they're trying to do that. It's a sure way to get beaten up.
Mary's jaw dropped open in horror.
It is not. My son would never get into a fight.
Is this the same child who tried to rewire the replicator to produce nothing but Rigelian triple fudge sundaes? The same child who caused that same replicator to malfunction, creating a continuous flow of green goop into your quarters until the chief engineer had to shut it off manually?
Don't remind me.
Mary winced in embarrassment.
Julia had to take the panel off while it was still oozing all that stuff, and let me tell you, she's got a temper on her when she's properly upset.
Being covered in green goop will do that to you.
Okay. You're right. He'll be fine.
Good.
Alex didn't doubt she would be revisiting this subject at least a dozen times more before they actually reached the resort.
Besides,
she continued speaking as the doors to the turbo lift slid open.
Think of it, room service for 5 whole days. Half-naked men bringing us drinks with those little umbrellas in it, massages, moonlight swims.
Not to mention the midnight activities.
Ezra Standish commented from his station with a grin of pure mischief.
We're going there to relax.
Alex bristled, even though it was not entirely a lie.
Sure you are.
Buck Wilmington said with a completely straight face as he looked over his shoulder at them and then flashed a more knowing grin at Chris Larrabee, who sniggered in complete awareness of his meaning. The senior staff was present on the bridge as the Maverick closed the distance between itself and the pleasure world of Pacifica. The idea of rest and recreation put everyone in a playful mood, a welcome respite after the trials faced recently. Before them, the view screen revealed the stars ahead, and the ship was cruising towards its destination at a comfortable speed of warp 7. At the rate they were traveling, they would arrive in Pacifica in little more than a day. Although it was possible to get there faster, Chris saw no reason to push the ship to its limits. Besides, some of the crew required time to plan their vacation arrangements while Buck needed to plan crew rotations so everyone got a chance for shore leave. Even the atmosphere on the bridge seemed similarly relaxed, as evidenced by the banner. Tethys Resort was the destination of choice for almost everyone requesting shore leave. Oceans made up 80% of Pacifica's surface. What land existed hosted its primary industry, tourism. The main body of the planet's inhabitants lived beneath the surface in large underwater domes called pavilions. Next to Risa, Pacifica was the Federation's most popular holiday venue.
Commander Wilmington.
Mary gave him a look as she and Alex split up. The science officer took her usual post while Mary returned to her seat next to the command chair at Chris's side.
Unlike your last trip to Risa, we are going to the Tethys Resort for a vacation, not a 7-day orgy.
Hey, an orgy is an overstatement.
Buck shrugged with no sign of repentance, having come away from that holiday very rested.
Not according to the number of women who contacted the ship to say goodbye when we went to get you.
JD quipped from his place at navigation control.
Shouldn't you be making sure we don't crash into a star or something?
Buck shot JD a glare of annoyance, but the navigator responded with an even more infuriating grin. From his captain's chair, Chris couldn't help comment.
Face it, Buck, your exploits are known far and wide throughout the ship.
And across bathroom walls in a dozen star systems.
What can I say? It's my animal magnetism. Women can't resist me.
He grinned devilishly and exacted a groan from the women in the room, rolled their eyes while the men broke into ripples of laughter.
And that ranks up there with the mystery of Atlantis and the riddle of the Sphinx.
Buck, however, was not about to be put down.
Don't worry, one day it will come to you girls too.
Unless you want to be cleaning EPS conduits for the rest of your term as my first officer, you better pray not.
Chris drawled, giving Buck a look that made the first officer question whether or not his captain was joking.
Thank you for the vote of confidence. Do you think I'll be unable to resist Commander Wilmington's considerable charms?
Well, Chris stammered.
Come on, Mary.
Vin Tanner interrupted to save his captain.
It's not that hard to resist Buck. All you need is a good flea collar.
Hey!
Buck exclaimed.
Nice try, Lieutenant.
Mary faced Chris to show he was nowhere out of trouble yet, and they would discuss this later.
So, where are you and Julia going to Ezra?
JD inquired, deciding it was necessary to move to a less volatile subject.
Oh, there's a nice romantic little inlet on the far side of the planet. Remote, luxurious, and definitely made for two individuals who want to bask in each other's company.
This time, Ezra picked the perfect getaway for himself and the lovely Miss Pemberton.
That's not all.
Ezra glared at him.
Unlike you, Commander, the sole purpose in my life is not to bed Julia. Engineering took the brunt of the damage during our engagement in the last battle of the war, and I believe she needs a perfectly restful place to recuperate.
I'm sure.
Buck rose from his chair.
Since our able science officer is here, if you don't mind, I'll make myself scarce. Please.
Ezra shook his head in a mixture of resignation and amusement when Buck took himself off the bridge. Mary was still staring after him like an unruly child making his escape before turning back to the conversation.
I think it's a pleasant idea. I know Julia's looking forward to it.
Julia had been speaking of nothing else since they discovered Pacifica was their intended destination for some well-needed short leave. Ezra wasn't wrong about the engineering team's need for rest. During the last few weeks, they held the ship together during the battle and put everything together again after it ended.
What about you, Captain?
JD asked, always burning with curiosity over what was happening on the ship.
We're going whitewater rafting on the Trident River.
Vin answered automatically.
I can never appreciate how you two willingly indulge any recreational time you have for such pursuits.
Ezra frowned in disapproval, even more so than usual. The Trident River was situated on the only mountain on the planet, where three mighty rivers converged into one, resulting in a river that was one of the fiercest and most challenging venues for whitewater rafting. The force of the trio of waterways draining into one created a powerful current capable of tearing boats to kindling if one was a novice. The captain's safety was one of Ezra's principal responsibilities, whether on the ship or off it. Unlike a holodeck program, there were no safety protocols in real life. Anything that went wrong could have permanent consequences. Ezra recognized the glimmer of excitement in Chris's eyes the moment Vin suggested the activity and guessed that any objections he made would be duly noted, tabled, and then ignored.
Ezra, we will have our comm badges on us at all times.
Chris wished he did not have to go through this every time he left the ship and went on vacation. He never had to worry about such things when he was the first officer. Why was it such a big deal because he was now captain?
I still have reservations about how effective they will be if any misfortune should occur.
Well, you can always come with us,
Vin suggested, aware of how to end this argument once and for all.
You know, keep an eye on Chris yourself.
Ezra merely looked at the officer of the con and replied simply,
have a wonderful trip.
She should have gone home. If she had been smart, she would have. However, when the time came to make that decision, Inez Rosillos found she could not. The pain inside her was still too raw, and she did not want to face her family's condolences because all that would do was make her remember him. She was barely holding herself together, trapped inside this darkened room where she did not want to hear of or speak to anyone. How could she cope if she went home? They had grown up in the town of Valverde together. Every road, every building, and tree in the place held some significance in her memories of him, and going back there would force her to remember every torturous fragment of her world that was Rafael Castile. There was this ache inside her breast so sharp she could not breathe. It was to be expected, Josiah said when he came to visit her a day or more ago. She could not remember for sure because Inez lost any sense of time. It was easy to do in space when there was no sun to mark days passing. Only stars seemed to pass by as the ship continued on its journey, speeding past with complete indifference to her pain. She always knew it could happen. She heard about the women who suffered the loss. As a bartender, she heard stories from men and women who lost loved ones in Starfleet. Inez thought if it became her turn, she could handle the anguish of losing Raphael in the line of duty. What she believed and what occurred were two distinct realities. It was unlike any pain she ever experienced in her entire life, and it sapped away her strength and her will to live, tumbling her headlong into oblivion. During the first few days, Mary was her most constant supporter, having lost her husband in the same manner during the last battle with the Borg over Earth. Inez drew comfort from the widow, but eventually, not even Mary's words of understanding could penetrate her grief, and she withdrew, appreciating that Inez needed solitude to deal with her sorrow. Inez did not know whether time would be enough. Although friends dropped in to see her, she could not seem to get her mind wrapped around their presence, and their attempts to help had little or no effect. She emerged from her quarters long enough to be present at the memorial held for the Venture and all its crew. Such events filled the calendar at DS9 following the battle at Cardassia. Inez endured the ceremony in a stupor, barely aware of anything as her friends converged upon her, offering support. A part of Inez could not associate the cold surface of the torpedo tube they had encased him in for his burial as Raphael. Not when it was a little over 2 weeks ago they made love inside this room when he came to see her. Inez understood his reasons for not wanting her on the front lines. As risky a mission as it was to patrol the frontier between the Alpha and Delta quadrants, it was nowhere as dangerous as maintaining the front lines of the war zone. Raphael knew dying was a possibility. Too many starships were destroyed during the war, and it was a fate he would not allow her to risk, so he asked her to take something out of the way. Inez obeyed because she loved him, never really believing he would die. A part of her still refused to accept it, and another part who knew better was twisting up inside with despair. Since then, Inez stayed in her quarters, doing nothing, haunting the rooms like a wraith, wallowing in sorrow, content to disappear completely into grief. When she heard the gentle chirp of someone at her door, Inez groaned inwardly. She had no desire for company and yet not possessing the lack of regard to ignore her caller. Dragging herself out of bed she had been trying to hide in for as long as possible, Inez padded to the door, grabbing her silk robe at the same time and pulling it over herself. Inez resolved to herself to get rid of whoever was at the door as quickly as possible, for she had no need for visitors or well-meaning friends. She did not wish to be rude or hurt anyone's feelings simply trying to help, but she had little tolerance for intrusion either. However, upon opening the door, Inez found herself faced with the one person she least expected to see throughout all this.
Buck, what are you doing here?
Hi, Inez. I came to see how you were doing.
Inez was still too astonished by his presence to do anything more than invite him in. Her relationship with the first officer of the Maverick was strange. She knew he was interested in her romantically, but then that was not saying much since any woman who passed his gaze caught Buck's attention. He differed from most philanderers because he never discarded his dalliances when his interest waned. They always parted as friends, and almost all the women she spoke to talked about the relationship with affection. Which confused her immensely about why he would be so determined to add her to his collection. While he had a shocking attitude toward his relations with women, he was also sensitive and genuinely cared about their feelings and was always careful not to hurt them. If she had not known this for a fact, Inez would have looked upon his presence here as being in the absolute worst taste.
How have you been, Inez?
Buck asked as the door slid close behind him and he quickly examined her quarters. If it was not for the air recyclers, he was sure the room would stink. Looking at the uneaten food on the pile of plates on the side of her bed and the fact almost everything else remained untouched, Buck had a clear idea of just how she was doing.
My fiancé just died. How do you think I feel?
She snapped and immediately regretted her words.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean.
Stupid question, Buck rebuked himself.
No, it's all right. I'm not doing too great, as you can see.
It was obvious, but he refused to pass judgment. He did not know how Inez felt, but his experience with Chris years before helped him understand the grieving process to some extent. Enough to know it was the people close by that made the difference.
You're entitled.
Thanks.
She smiled faintly at him, pleased he was not unloading on her with advice and platitudes.
To tell you the truth, I'm not really in the mood for company.
I know.
Buck was here more for his own sake than anyone else's. He was going crazy, not knowing how she was faring, and needed to see for himself she was all right. Of course, this was not far removed from what he had expected to see. She was naturally going to be shattered following Raphael's death. He saw how they had been when the captain of the Venture had come aboard to know she had loved him profoundly and perhaps always would.
I won't stay long. I just wanted to see if you were all right and if you needed anything.
Always the first officer.
Something like that.
Buck averted his eyes so she could not tell what was running through his heart. This was hardly the time for it.
Thank you. I'll be okay, in time.
Inez confessed and surprised herself when she believed it to be the truth.
If you need anything,
he said, letting his emotions show.
I'll even listen.
The sentiment touched Inez, even though she was unsure what motivated it. Still, she sensed it was not some tasteless effort to impress her. What it might be was something she could not cope with right now, no matter how much the possibility surprised her.
Audrey, what a delightful surprise. What can I do for you?
Josiah Sanchez exclaimed at seeing her in his office. While accustomed to Lilith King dropping in at random intervals to see him, it was the first time Josiah remembered Lilith's mother, Audrey, doing the same. Not that he minded. Josiah and Audrey often ran into each other since their first encounter during the recent Dominion attack on this ship. She was a lovely woman, with dark auburn hair and inquiring blue eyes that could reach into the soul and grab you by the throat if you were not careful. The rather colorful description Josiah inadvertently made surprised him. Feeling slightly unsettled by that thought, he shook away the notion and focused his mind on why she was here.
You know, I am organizing a field trip to Pacifica for my class.
Audrey forced the words out and wondered why she ought to be so nervous about such a simple task.
Yes, Lilith mentioned something about it. I think it's a wonderful idea.
Thank you.
She smiled nervously. Once again, Josiah admired the way it seemed to light up her face and caused another flutter in his stomach.
The problem is we've hit a snag. Lieutenant Holden was going to assist me in chaperoning the children, but she's come down with a case of Kaltorian flu. I've tried the other teachers, but they've organized outings for their classes, and I really didn't want to disappoint the children. They had their hearts set on the trip.
Josiah could attest to that. Lilith talked about nothing else and would be disappointed if the trip was canceled.
That's unfortunate. I know Lilith was really looking forward to it.
Audrey cleared her throat and then got to the point of her visit to his office.
I was hoping perhaps you would consent to come in Lieutenant Holden's place.
Me?
Yes. You're wonderful with the children, and Lilith said you have been to Pacifica before.
Yes.
Josiah nodded, his mind whirling at the idea. He had no plans for the furlough, and vacation was not something he had really given much thought to since Isla's passing. This mainly was because time spent doing nothing would usually cause him to think about his wife and, by extension, remind him how much he missed her.
I used to vacation there with my wife and our children when they were young enough to appreciate it.
I'm sorry.
Audrey looked dismayed at being the reason for dredging up that pain.
If you don't want to do it, I understand. I just thought.
No, it's all right.
Josiah moved quickly to allay any fear she might have at causing him discomfort. It had been a year since his wife had departed from this life, and he could not avoid the places they had been forever. After all, did he not tell his patients who suffered the same loss when it was time to move on? This time, the advice was for a patient closer to home. Physician, heal thyself.
I'll be happy to do it,
Josiah announced, taking a deep breath and deciding to let nothing hold him back.
Really? The children will be so pleased. I know Lilith will be.
She beamed radiantly at his acceptance. Somehow, Josiah had a hard time distinguishing whether she was not a little happy herself that he was joining her and did not have time to ponder the issue before she left his office again. However, after she had gone, Josiah suddenly remembered he was going to one of the most romantic places in the quadrant with a woman he admired. Perhaps he should have thought this through. Chapter 1. Artifact. The artifact floated in space. The vacuum of deep space kept it perfectly preserved for the eternity it wandered through the void, a shape of geometric lines fashioned out of a crystalline substance whose sculptors had long since passed. It hurtled through the black endlessly without destination, joining the many others drifting nomadically between the stars, waiting for its time. For a few, the end would come abruptly in the gravitational field of a planet or a star, admired briefly as a shooting star in the night sky before burning up forever. Over the centuries, ships had passed it by. Some paused long enough to look, only to continue on again, offering no salvation from the wilderness. Many passed, some in ignorance while others with indifference. It watched them come and go, praying for release that never seemed to come. Time lengthened, stretched, and finally disappeared into the distance, leaving behind despair and more waiting. Hope dwindled along with patience because immortality was torture when one was trapped for all time. Then one day, a ship appeared, and instead of veering away like others had done time and time again, this one slowed.
What is it?
Chris Larrabee asked from the bridge of the Maverick. The object was beautiful, whatever it was. On the viewer, it hurtled in silent grace through the void, almost invisible because there was no light to allow anyone to see it, let alone admire its inherent beauty. Illumination was hardly a problem when several million tones of starship closed in on it. 1,000 points of light from the many windows, portals, observation decks, and other plexiglass view stations bounced off the smooth, crystal surface. It hit the object like the light of sunrise, brilliantly displaying the facets of its reflective crystal surface. For an instant, it looked like the brightest star in the sky.
Unknown.
Alex was the only one on the bridge, not focused on the scene beyond the port bow of the Maverick. Across the bridge, activity slowed to a crawl, with only Alex working quickly to answer what it was they were all gaping at with such awe.
It could be a probe.
I don't think so.
Vin shook his head, his cobalt-colored eyes fixed on the view screen, admiring the iridescent glow of the object each time it moved across the nose of the ship. He only needed to nudge the controls gently to keep it there, using thruster control to maintain the Maverick's position.
I don't see anything that could be a propulsion system.
Vin's right.
Chris agreed with the helmsman but awaited Alex to produce a better description. His science officer hated puzzles, and any she could not solve would become her very own demon until she cracked the mystery surrounding it. In that way, she was like every other science officer he ever met.
It's not natural, is it?
He mused once more and looked over his shoulder for confirmation. The wonder of space made it difficult to make assumptions without scans, examination, and analysis. Too many times over the years, explorers encountered objects, life forms, and spatial phenomena that, by all rights, should not exist but did because they didn't know enough to understand better.
Without more specific scans, I'd say that thing is a construct.
Alex was glad to give the captain something. Sometimes, people confuse the science officer as the fountain of all knowledge. Science officers were only as good as the data they worked with, and the current situation provided her with very little to make an informed judgment.
The cut of the object is too precise to be a natural formation, and judging by the measurements which are symmetrical, I would say that they cut it to size, probably out of a single block of crystal.
Amazing.
Mary commented, her blue-gray eyes sparkling with curiosity. The object was a tribute to craftsmanship and ought to be enjoyed by thousands, not left to languish in the frozen gaps of stellar space.
It's so beautiful.
Mary's experience with space exploration was limited. While the others prepared for life and careers in the cosmos, Mary spent hers in conference rooms. Her understanding of new cultures and traditions occurred with diplomats around conference tables, not among the spaceways. Being protocol officer for the Maverick placed her at the forefront of new life and civilizations, which was as far from her previous experience as she could get. Thus being in this new environment allowed Mary to view every discovery with the eyes of a child in a playground. The Maverick had been traveling to Pacifica when sensors detected the object they were now studying with such interest. At first, they thought it merely a piece of space debris, but Alex, being the thorough officer she was, discovered there was more to the spatial flotsam than first glances might indicate. Although there was never any danger of a collision with the Maverick since proximity alerts would have screamed warning long before any threat materialized, other ships may not be so fortunate. It was never wise to assume every vessel flying through the vicinity possessed the technological sophistication of a galaxy-class starship. What may be harmless to them could kill someone else. Either way, Chris was not about to risk it.
Could it be a weapon?
Ezra Standish was not taken in by the mystery artifact's beauty. His comrade's reaction to the thing was half the reason for his concern, and he wondered whether someone sculpted the object to produce the response he was seeing in them now. Nothing could be more disarming than masking the lethal beneath something so captivating. Like flypaper.
I don't think so.
Alex glanced at Ezra and saw he was deadly serious about the question. In all honesty, she could not blame him. He was the security officer, and it was his job.
It reads as completely solid. There's no room for any mechanism, and its composition is the same throughout.
Still, as Alex studied the readings on her console, she wished she could be entirely sure about that.
Unless it possesses technology that is so far unknown to anything in the Alpha Quadrant.
That is what I fear.
Ezra frowned, not at all willing to shake the belief there was something amiss in the spectacle of debris before them.
Actually, if I didn't know better, I would say that it's some kind of storage crystal, not unlike the ones used by the Cardassians.
Cardassian security crystals are 30 centimeters long.
Vin looked at Alex over his shoulder.
That thing is almost 10 meters and 4 across.
Yeah, but I think she's right.
JD agreed, having come to the same conclusion.
It's emitting some type of harmonic frequency the closer we get to it, possibly a beacon.
So, what's it doing out here?
Chris asked out loud, not really expecting an answer.
As far as I know, there is no spacefaring race in the immediate vicinity. It could have come from Pacifica, but their technology isn't capable of creating something like this.
Captain!
Alex exclaimed, the tone of her voice changing enough for Chris to swivel around in his chair.
What?
Alex didn't immediately answer. Her hands flew across her console as she tried to reconfirm her astonishing discovery. Aware of Chris's finite patience, Alex finally broke her silence.
According to my scans, that thing is almost half a million years old.
A low whistle escaped someone behind them. Chris thought it might be JD.
My God, how long do you think it's been out here?
It's impossible to say without more detailed analysis.
The science officer answered, still stunned by her findings. She stared at it through the viewer for a few seconds, as if a visual study would give her the answer scans would not.
I need to examine it with more specialized equipment than this.
You want to bring it on board?
Ezra looked at her, not liking that idea at all, not when its origins were still a mystery. The way it captured everyone's attention made Ezra very nervous.
Captain, that is unwise. We know nothing about it or its purpose. With all due respect to Commander Stiles, everything we know about it is speculation, not hard data. For all we know, it's a trap left here for some unsuspecting soul to find.
Captain.
Alex understood Ezra's objections but disagreed with him on the most fundamental level.
That is a significant piece of construction floating out there in space. It's like has never been encountered by any Federation ship. We cannot just keep going and ignore it simply because we do not know what it is. Ezra is right. We don't know its exact purpose, but I think it could be a data storage device. For all we know, that crystal could be the last record of a civilization that wanted someone to know who they were. It seems terribly short-sighted of us if we just ignored it and let their voices go unheard.
Okay.
Chris conceded defeat because he was a little moved by her impassioned plea. Sometimes Alex could be a hard-nosed pain in the butt, but she was an excellent officer and a true explorer, a trait Chris shared with her. Besides, Chris wanted to know what it was as much as she did.
You convinced me, Commander. Transporter.
Captain.
Ezra interrupted, still having several reservations over this course of action.
Ezra, it's coming on board,
Chris said firmly before adding in a more conciliatory note.
However, you will put that thing through its paces. Keep it in a level 5 force field before you clear it technologically, microscopically, and any other way a talented security officer like you can think of to ensure it's safe. Until I'm convinced there is no danger to the ship, no one gets near it. Is that understood?
Chris aimed his warning at Alex in particular. Alex nodded, showing she understood Ezra's authority on this matter and would adhere to whatever he felt was the best way to proceed. Although she was a scientist by nature, she was also a Starfleet officer, and the welfare of her crew came first.
Transporter room.
Chris spoke out loud.
Transporter Chief Rain here, sir.
There is an object on our port bow. The science station is sending coordinates right now. I want you to lock on and transport it to Cargo Bay 1. Place it in level 5 containment.
Aye, Captain.
All eyes turned to the screen as they watched the artifact in the viewer, glowing like a Catherine wheel when the light bounced off its flawless surface. As the transporter beam locked onto it, a shimmer of gold descended over the object before it vanished off the screen altogether. Transporter Chief Rain's voice sang through the bridge in all its melodic tones a moment later.
The object is in Cargo Bay 1, Captain, under Level 5 containment.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
Chris turned to Alex and Ezra again.
It's all yours.
Ever since coming on board the Maverick, Josiah found the one person he could truly call a professional colleague and a peer was Nathan Jackson. It was challenging to get to know the doctor, even though outwardly, he appeared a friendly sort. Nathan's true personality hidden beneath the reassuring facade of the chief medical engineer was not so easy to discern. He was a man of surprising sensitivity who would have been a more than able counselor if it was not for the fact healing was his true calling. And he truly was born to it. Josiah watched Nathan mend bones, cure ailments, and treat patients with such care, it was almost a pleasure to see. children coming in with scraped knees and teary eyes, usually left with smiles that had little to do with Nathan's treatment but how he had made them feel. Josiah's friendship with Nathan had been slow to form. Their offices were down the corridor from one another, so it was inevitable they would see each other a great deal. Although they were senior staff, neither was required on the bridge. Thus, whenever the situation got tense, both men usually rode out the storm over a bottle of Romulan ale. Once Josiah got to know Nathan very well, he understood why the man took his patience and his ability to heal so seriously. Until the age of 17, his only family was his sister, Rebecca. Growing up on one of the outer colony worlds where medical treatment was scarce, Rebecca was struck with Andalusian fever, an ailment whose symptoms were so slight they could be easily mistaken for the common flu. The doctor on the colony dismissed his concerns, despite Nathan's insistence otherwise. When the virus flared, its effects were nothing less than devastating. Within a day, nearly all her body functions had shut down, and in less time than that, she was gone. It was a loss Josiah suspected Nathan had never recovered from, and it showed in his attitude to his patients. These days, their friendship was at a point where Josiah sought Nathan when he needed counsel himself because the younger man was insightful and willing to listen.
"So let me get this straight,"
Nathan said to Josiah inside the confines of the doctor's private office.
"She asked you to join her on this field trip."
"That's right, but I don't think I'm ready."
"To go on a field trip?"
Nathan eyed him over the cup of ale from which he was about to take a sip. Sitting across from his desk with his own glass, Josiah gave the doctor a look.
"No, for a relationship."
"Whoa."
Nathan put down the glass and stared at the counselor.
"When did we go from a field trip to a relationship?"
"Well, I'm sure that's where it's going,"
Josiah said, somewhat annoyed Nathan couldn't see the obvious.
"I mean, out of the people on the ship, she came to see me? Obviously she wants me."
Nathan kept a straight face.
"Obviously. What about you? Do you like Audrey?"
Josiah hesitated now, uncertain about his answer.
"She's a pleasant woman, reminds me a lot of—"
He paused a moment as it became a little difficult to continue. He thought he had become used to Ayla being gone, that missing her was only natural. They spent so many years together. It was natural that her being gone would be with him for a long time, but until Audrey came into his life, Josiah had never been as uncomfortable about it as he did now.
"Of your wife?"
"A little, but it's not just that Audrey's a lot like Ayla, but there's something about her personally. I could care about her."
Nathan took a deep breath, knowing what exactly the problem was.
"Josiah, it's okay for you to go on with your life. I know you loved Ayla very much, but ask yourself, would she want you to carry on alone?"
"Of course not,"
Josiah said automatically, even though he and Ayla never even discussed the possibility, mainly because neither could imagine their lives without each other. "You don't have to feel guilty about liking this woman, Josiah." Nathan wondered what it must be like to love someone nearly 25 years and then suddenly have her disappear. What kind of void did that leave behind? Nathan had relationships in his past, but good relationships were hard to maintain when his work came first. At what point did caring for one's patients take a backseat to a more personal love? Nathan always found he had difficulty making that choice, so he was still alone.
"I know."
Josiah reached the same conclusion, although it was nice to hear someone else tell him.
"I guess I've been so happy on this ship the last few months I forgot how much I missed Ayla, and all this just brought it back."
Nathan took a moment to consider what was the best thing to say to the man.
"If you had a patient, someone who lost his wife a year ago and is now feeling as if he might be ready to care about someone else again but is a little anxious, what would you say to him?"
A wan smile curled the edge of Josiah's lips.
"Probably that it is natural to feel this way. Take it one day at a time and see how he feels about it and not assume too much. Just play it out, keeping in mind that life goes on and sometimes the past needs to take a backseat to the future."
"Well, there you go. Good advice, coming from the best counselor I know."
"Sneaky but helpful."
Josiah let out a slight laugh when a message across the comm system suddenly interrupted their conversation.
"Dr. Jackson, please report to Cargo Bay 1 with full medical decontamination equipment."
"Looks like you're on,"
Josiah replied as Nathan sighed and put down his glass. Technically, he was off duty. But Nathan, like most CMOs, lived inside their offices.
"The life of a star."
The doctor stood up and headed for the door.
"Hey Nathan,"
Josiah called out before he left the room.
"Yeah,
Thanks,
Josiah said with heartfelt sincerity.
Anytime, brother.
Nathan grinned and kept going. Ezra insisted on the artifact being thoroughly analyzed, so it was a good few hours before he felt it was safe to deactivate the level 5 containment field surrounding it. Ezra knew he was being overly cautious, but while the unknown could yield fantastic marvels awaiting discovery, danger could also lie in wait. As much as he would like to be fascinated by this crystal sculpture, Ezra could not do so without compromising his duty. The lives of 1,000 people counted on his ability to examine a situation objectively. Julia's engineering team went over the artifact micron by micron, confirming Alex's initial assessment that it was a solid block of crystal. The properties of the crystal seemed to imply it was some type of storage device, although what it could contain was beyond their understanding. It was like a massive shard of crystal floating in space, shaped like a thin wedge broken off from a larger object. It lost much of its mystique under the gleam of the cargo bay lights, but was still an artifact worthy of interest. After Julia completed her work, Nathan conducted the same strenuous examination, ensuring no spaceborne microbes penetrated the screening process of the transporter system to endanger the ship. His inspection of the object was just as laborious. Nathan noted its similarity to Ferengi thought makers, devices with the ability to supplant brainwaves with others. While this gave Ezra some cause for concern, Nathan assured him this made sense if the device was intended for data storage.
So, can I get a crack at it now?
Alex asked hours later. By now, the only ones left in the room with a strange construct were herself and the chief security officer.
I suppose, I still believe this is a bad idea.
Of course you do.
Alex deadpanned as she walked towards the object lying on its side in the middle of the cargo bay.
You're the chief security officer. You have to be a pessimist.
My dear lady, I am not a pessimist. I am merely being careful and saving those of you in pursuit of scientific discovery from yourselves.
And we all admire the way you handle the responsibility.
She threw him a playful wink as she reached the object and started programming the tricorder in her hands.
I think I shall leave you two alone.
Ezra had done all that he could, and it was time to leave Alex to her new toy. She reacted to his remark with a dismissive wave before starting her work. Without further comment, the security chief left the room. Alex let out a sigh when he was gone and hoped Julia would soon put the man out of his misery by consummating their relationship. The lack of sex was obviously the reason Ezra was so testy lately. According to Julia, this was her plan when Ezra whisked her away for this romantic vacation in Pacifica. What Alex did not mention at the time was that she was sure this was what Ezra had in mind too. Alex focused her attention on the artifact, admiring the flawless finish of its polished surface. Pressing her palm flat against the crystal, she felt its cool on her skin. After being in the freezing temperature of space, it was taking time to absorb the heat from inside the ship, mostly because the crystal was not the best conductor of such things. A jolt of energy from the artifact struck her in spidery tendrils. The overload to her senses was so complete it blinded all thought from her mind before enveloping her in cool, comforting darkness. Chapter 2. The Many. The unexpected summons to Cargo Bay 1 at the request of Alexandra Stiles surprised Mary, mostly because she found the whole thing odd. After all, she was a protocol officer whose expertise lay in linguistics and xenoanthropology, not to mention a healthy knowledge of Federation, Klingon, and Romulan constitutional law. What contribution she could make regarding the alien artifact the Maverick sighted floating in space would be minimal, but her curiosity was more than a little piqued by the possibility. Besides, Mary could not lie. She didn't mind a closer look at the artifact. Despite all the danger she faced during her time on the Maverick, there was something inherently fulfilling about the exploration of uncharted space. They encountered more alien species last month onboard the Maverick than Mary would ever have come across after a year at the Vulcan Embassy. With the Borg attacks and the recent Dominion War, Starfleet struggled to find experienced officers. Mary understood the posting here. Starfleet could not leave an officer of her experience to languish on a diplomatic posting when a starship was in need. Mary could no longer imagine being anywhere else, despite her initial apprehension at accepting the post. Much of this had to do with Chris Larrabee and their relationship slowly inching towards apogee.
She had also come to understand he would be a permanent fixture in her life. For her son, Chris filled the void left behind by the death of her husband, Sion, and recently Mary started calling her child Billy instead of William. Sion's family would never approve, of course, and Mary had this terrible premonition that one day, she would face a situation where she would have to fight for Billy's right to grow up as he wanted. Mary continued her ruminations inside the turbo lift that took her to the cargo hold decks with a detour at engineering. As the door slid open, Julia Pemberton stepped inside.
Hi, Mary.
Julia greeted as the doors closed behind her.
Computer, cargo bay 1.
Mary stared at her.
You too?
You're headed there as well.
Julia reacted with a hint of surprise.
Yes, Alex asked me to meet her down there. I assume it has something to do with that crystal artifact they beamed on board earlier today.
I heard we'd picked something up. Do we have any idea of what it is?
Not really. Before we brought it on board, Alex claimed it was almost 500,000 years old. It is beautiful though,
she said, still awed by what they had seen of it on the view screen.
So why does she need us? Lieutenant Potter is the archaeological expert on board.
Who knows? Maybe it has nothing to do with the object at all. Perhaps she wanted to see us for something else. We're going to the Tethys Resort when we get to Pacifica, although that would not explain why she would ask for you too.
Maybe she needs a neutral opinion on how to spend your time while you engage in your debauch down there.
Hilarious. I'll have you know that there will be no debauchery going on. I am there for the rest.
Uh-huh.
The petite redhead responded with a look of pure skepticism.
I would not cast stones from my glass house.
Mary eyed Julia with a glimmer of mischief in the narrow confines of the lift.
Since you and Ezra are going to an isolated resort away from the world and the ship, don't tell me you'll need more than one room.
Julia blushed and gave herself away wholly.
Okay, I admit it. Sex is on the agenda.
Thank God. I think the man is about to snap.
Well, I wanted to take it slow. He means a lot to me, and I just don't want to rush into things. I mean, Ezra is complex.
Mary gave her a sidelong glance.
That's one way to put it.
You know what I mean.
I know what you mean, but you've been together for months now. I think it's obvious how Ezra feels about you. He can't help it if he is the most cynical human being to emerge from the primordial soup.
I know. But a man who wears a poker face like his is hard to read, and I didn't want to get hurt.
Unfortunately.
Mary sighed, offering the younger woman the benefits of her experience.
That's the risk you take with relationships. There is no way to play it safe. Believe me, I know.
Julia nodded in understanding. A deep silence lapsed over the conversation for a few seconds until the turbo lift doors slid open, and they emerged into the corridor where the cargo hold was situated.
Maybe Alex cracked the thing open and found the body of a 20th century movie star, alive and well but completely brain dead and starving for female company.
Mary looked at Julia with a sly smile.
I always had a thing for Michael B. and myself.
She could sense the coming of the two. She felt their life force resonating down the hallway upon approach and assessed whether they were suitable to complete the triumvirate to unseal the others. After so long, drifting in the nightmarish void of space, watching helplessly in their prison, powerless to escape its horror, she was eager to begin. Every second of their long imprisonment remained vivid in their memory and regarded with contempt. She would never go back to it again. Freeing the others was imperative. They needed to breathe air through their lungs once more, to feel the blood pumping through their hearts and the passion of life surging through flesh and blood bodies. When she first claimed this vessel as her own, her mind had swum with the sensations of touch, sight, and sound. After almost 500,000 years of existing as nothing but energy trapped in a crystal coffin, the feelings were as close to ecstasy as one could imagine. She had to share it with the others. And she would. The doors to the cargo hold bay slid open, and the two needed to become three arrived. They saw the vessel and found nothing amiss as they advanced deeper into the room, admiring the object that was nothing but a coffin for innocents buried alive. They called it beautiful. She would have snorted in derision if it did not mean shedding the facade needed until the joining was complete.
So, what's up?
Julia asked as she approached Alex, who stood next to the artifact. As Julia neared it, she admitted Mary's description of it being beautiful did not do it justice. The engineering to shape this crystal block did not exist even now, and Julia wondered about the race that inspired its creation. She was almost eager to take a tricorder to it herself and study it. Now she understood why Alex insisted it being brought on board, since it did indeed appear to be an astonishing find.
"I needed you both to see something,"
Alex said stiffly.
"It's even more beautiful up close."
Mary crossed the space between herself and the artifact.
"It's incredible that it remained intact for as long as it has."
"Space is a big place,"
Julia remarked, joining her advance.
"It could have drifted indefinitely. There are probably objects like this scattered throughout the quadrant, waiting for someone to pick them up as we did this one."
"Yes,"
Alex agreed, giving them an enigmatic smile.
"It was fortunate."
"So, what is it?"
"There is something I require your opinion on."
Alex placed her palm on the smooth surface of the artifact, inviting them to do the same.
"I believe it is warm."
"Warm?"
Julia stared at her incredulously.
"How can it have a temperature? It's been out in a vacuum."
"I do not know. It just is."
"And why am I here?"
Mary inquired, wondering if there was something odd about Alex's behavior. She seemed more aloof than usual. This aspect of her personality had taken time for her crewmates to recognize. It was an effort well worth the trouble. Beneath Alex's mercurial and dry nature was a softer woman than she would let most believe.
"I thought you might like to see it close up. Touch it,"
she urged, keeping her hand against the crystal surface.
"You'll see why."
Mary and Julia exchanged a curious glance and decided there had to be something extraordinary for Alex to make such an effort for them to experience it. Usually, whenever the science officer stumbled onto such oddities, she would not tolerate the interference of anyone in her investigation and was absolutely relentless in protecting what she called the scientific integrity of the study.
"This had better be good,"
Julia said with mock annoyance and put her hand against the artifact at the same time that Mary did. The effect was instantaneous. Tendrils of energy sparked from the crystal, enveloping the trio in brilliant white globes. Alex, who underwent the process earlier, escaped the acute effects, unlike Mary and Julia, who jerked with uncontrollable spasms as alien power invaded their bodies. The dance of light and flesh took place for only a moment, and the glow that briefly turned the artifact into a brilliant spectrum of color soon darkened, its energies drained from the many facets of its crystalline form. Mary and Julia tumbled to the ground, boneless as they impacted on the cold floor of the deck. As Alex stood and continued to watch, she felt no fear about their well-being. The process was no good if the vassals required to carry them anywhere to die. There was so much to do. After so many years trapped in space, the many's patience had dwindled to almost nothingness. For the first time in too long, they lived and breathed again. They could not waste the chance to accomplish what remained undone. To succeed, they needed to hurry before the hated ones, like the Dia who did this to them, tried to interfere. Mary stirred first, groaning in pain as her body became accustomed to itself after what had transpired. She pushed herself onto her hands and knees and then stretched languidly, like a cat curled into a ball of sleep for hours. Groans of aches quickly dissipating soon evaporated into the laughter of delight. Mary laughed out loud in a voice very much like her vassal, only full of playful mischief.
"It has been too long.
They have trapped us in this prison."
Alex glared viciously at the crystal artifact with black hatred.
"For almost 500,000 years.
500,000.
The exultation of being alive drained from Mary's face.
"I thought it might have been long, but not for eons."
"We must return home immediately."
"Yes."
Julia, who was the last to recover, spoke in a low voice, colder and far harsher than that of the owner of her body.
"We must go home and find out what it is those animals that did this to us have done to the homeworld, if there is one even left for us to return to."
"We have no other choice but to try,"
Mary responded, agreeing entirely with that statement.
"We have nowhere else to go."
"We have more immediate problems to deal with."
Alex stared at both of them.
"We must free the others. My vassal shows there is more than enough on board this ship to play host to the others."
"Dia governs this ship."
Mary's eyes narrowed into slits. Her hatred was so intense it almost felt tangible.
"They will not take us home.
The combined knowledge of the vassals we now inhabit and the ones we will soon take will not make that a problem,"
Julia said coldly.
"We must keep them occupied,"
Mary added her voice to the discussion.
"With the hated ones, the usual way will suffice."
The entity residing inside the chief engineer responded with apparent derision. Time robbed her of whatever compassion that might have existed once. Years of praying and futility had driven everything inside her that cared into the oblivion of vengeance. Until they saw the familiar skies of home, nothing would assuage the terrible rage at the injustice done to them.
The knowledge of my vessel tells me much about these species. They do not differ from the ones we knew from our time. These federations claim benevolence, but their kind always dominates, always seeks to remain above the many. Let them continue to underestimate us. By the time they understand what is happening, it will be too late. We will have this ship.
They left the cargo bay hold, fanning out to different parts of the ship, like soldiers extending the battle lines as they enter the Maverick's general population. Once the triumvirate drew the essence of the many from its crystal confinement, the gaining of new vassals would be nowheres over it. It would require little more than physical contact for a vassal to be taken from this point on. Julia appeared in engineering and gained everyone there useful for the purpose. Upon passing the many to others, the newly taken could do the same, spreading beyond the walls of the Maverick's heart like cancer at its most virulent. The hated ones suspected nothing. They went about their business, unaware the seeds for their surrender were being laid as they continued on their way, oblivious. Mary Travis went to visit her son at school and made everyone their vassals for the many. The many did not wish to inhabit children, but several were acceptable, so the many grew yet again. A pat on the back, a brush of fingertips against the skin allowed passage through the ranks of the crew, and there would be other forms of attack as well, not just the possession of bodies. The enemy was not stupid, and the oldest of the arts had to be employed most fully to give the conqueror the advantage. The many would take no chances as they continued their silent revolution. Alexandra Stiles did not go to the bridge. The many's hold on the Maverick was still too vulnerable to attempt infiltrating that vital system of the ship. They would fight the battle there soon enough. Instead, she traveled through the ranks of her science department, enlisting new soldiers from astrophysics, stellar cartography, and astrometrics. By the time she had set her sights on Four Corners, almost a third of the ship had succumbed to the invasion, with no one being the least bit aware of it. It was time to put their plan into motion. Now no one could stop them. There was something strange going on. Upon concluding her duty shift, Transporter Chief Rain Null decided upon a very definitive course of action. She would go to her quarters and soak in her bath. Should anyone choose to interfere with this plan, which she had decided most strongly was a good one, she would simply have to beam them onto the bridge nude when they were not looking. This was no empty threat. An instructor at the academy who would never sleep easy again could verify this for sure. Despite the official reprimand in her service record for the illegal use of a transporter, Rain regretted nothing. She suspected she gained the posting to the Maverick because Captain Larrabee believed anyone capable of beaming someone out of their bed and planting them in the middle of the academy mess hall could transport his crew anywhere and back again. Whatever the reason, Rain did not care. Being a Trill could be intensely liberating. The symbiote inside her allowed Rain to remember the past lives of everyone who was its host, and it gave her a fresh perspective on things. Death didn't frighten her because she passed on her life to the symbiote, along with all her eccentricities. It also allowed her to draw on the experiences of other hosts when a situation confused her. At the moment, the Trill named Rain found that experience did not entirely cover this. Rain had no telepathic ability besides the memories of those before her. However, she sensed something was wrong. People walked past her, looking no different from every other day, yet they did not seem right. She could not tell how it was there, lying in wait like the stink of dank water at the bottom of an old well. Friends and colleagues walked past her in the quarters as she made her way through the saucer section back to her quarters to the bath she intended to enjoy soon. They acknowledged her presence but little else. All appeared glazed and detached. Not just the Starfleet personnel, but the civilians too. Rain wondered if it was just her as she reached the turbo lift that would take her to her quarters. Still, the disadvantage of the host experience was the jumble of mixed signals from too many voices trying to express themselves simultaneously. However, Rain's gut instinct told her this was not so. She tried not to ignore her gut instincts because it was the one thing she could truly call her own. Rain relied upon it like the captain relied upon his ship, and when it said something bad was going down, Rain believed wholeheartedly.
"Rain,"
a voice said behind her as the doors to the turbo lift slid open. And Rain jumped a little, easily startled by the cloud of paranoia slowly taking hold of her mind, telling her something sinister was afoot. Rain turned to see Alexandra Stiles and felt a surge of relief. As far as Rain was concerned, Alex Stiles was the most formidable intellect on the ship. Well, the captain and Commander Wilmington didn't really count. They were men.
Commander Stiles, am I glad to see you?
Is something wrong?
Alex's tone was glacial. She must not be having a good day. Considering that Rain was experiencing the same, she supposed they had that in common, though Rain didn't mention it.
Do you notice people behaving strangely?
Rain asked, glancing at the faces passing them by in the corridor. Alex stared at her, her expression stonier than ever. No, perhaps it is just you. With that, Alex placed her hand on Rain's shoulder just as the door to the turbo lift opened. Rain felt the contact of skin before something struck her with the sharpness of an icicle being driven straight into her mind. The young woman staggered forward, unaware Alex did not follow her into the lift until the doors closed behind her. The agony was so intense Rain could feel the other sharing her mind, scream with the same excruciating pain as she crumpled to her knees, clutching her head and trying not to scream. The mental quake reverberated in her mind like a struck tuning fork that did not end until it finally exhausted itself. How long she remained on the floor of the turbo lift, gasping out in pain, trying not to let those strained groans become shrieks, was a mystery. When it finally receded, it left Rain on the floor, panting hard, trying to understand what had just happened to her.
Oh, girl.
Rain groaned as she struggled to her feet.
I think it's about time you made a trip to see a doctor.